When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. My guest today is E.J. Coe. E.J. Coe is the author of the memoir, The Magical Language of Others, which won a Washington State Book Award, Pacific Northwest Book Award, Association for Asian American Studies Book Award, and was longlisted for the Penn Open Book Award. Coe is also the author of the poetry collection A Lesser Love, a Pleiades Press Editor's Prize for Poetry winner. She earned her MFA at Columbia University in New York for creative writing and literary translation, and her PhD at the University of Washington in English language and literature, studying Korean-American literature, history, and film. Coe has received National Endowment for the Arts, McDowell, American Literary Translators Association, and Kundiman Fellowships. She lives in Seattle, Washington. Her debut novel, The Liberators, out on Tin House November 7th, is one of LitHub's most anticipated books of 2023. The Liberators is an exquisitely drawn portrait and symphonic testimony of guards, prisoners, perpetrators, and liberators spanning continents and four generations of two Korean families forever changed by fateful past decisions made in love and war. Beautiful and deeply moving, The Liberators is an elegantly wrought family saga of memory, trauma, and empathy, and a stunning testament to the consequences and fortunes of inheritance. Welcome, EJ. I'm so happy to talk to you. I'm really grateful that you had the time to come on. This book is holy shit amazing.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. I've been listening to your interviews for quite a while now. And so it's exciting to hear your voice.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I love hearing that.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Do you want to read a little bit?
Yes, I have something for you. It's from the perspective of Henry, young boy's dog, Toto. Mm-hmm. And it's Toto is already quite old, and he sort of sees the family dynamic and relationship with Henry in a way that gives us another I suppose a shade to all that's going on. One morning after the cold season came and went, Toto found a quiet spot on the sidewalk. It was a place where he could stay and breathe softly and lie still. Toto had always known these things to make sense. When the boy's mother found him, she brought him to a place where there was a white room. They put him in a cage with a pad underneath, ripped up by other dogs. Toto was getting tired, and if he wanted to, he could sleep. Toto planned to do just that, but hadn't seen the boy. The boy's father came and dropped off Toto in another white room. It was bigger and brighter. They put Toto on a table where he waited for the boy. They put things before his eyes, but Toto didn't pay them any attention. More time went by. Toto waited until noon when the boy's mother showed up again. "Something we do," they said, is check if his eyes follow anything in front of him, if he's interested or if he's just there but not looking at us. The boy appeared in the doorway. Toto looked up for the first time and the boy looked at him. "These things," they said, "they happen so fast in smaller dogs. There are little signs to go by, and by the time we notice them, it's hard to turn things around." The boy's mother picked him up. "I'm so sorry, Toto." Toto was comfortable. His gaze went up to hers. "I didn't know, Toto," she said. "I shouldn't have worried so much. I should have thanked you for loving my son instead." She passed Toto to the boy. Leaving his mother with the people in the white room, the boy took Toto to the car. The boy was distraught. He put Toto on his lap. "You don't smell like yourself, Toto. You're a little sour." Toto's head rested comfortably on the boy's arm. "We can't fix everything for you. You have to want to stay with us, Toto. You do want to stay, don't you?" The first notes of sleep fell on Toto, touching his eyes. "I don't have anybody but you," and the boy started to shake. Toto's breathing slowed, his fur sank into his ribs. Now the boy seemed to understand. Toto wanted the boy to see for himself what Toto had accepted a long time ago, and if Toto could do it, then he was sure the boy could do it too. "Toto, don't go. Please stay." The boy rocked him. "It's not real, Toto. It's not happening, Toto." Here they were together, their seeing eyes, serious ears. Here were the months they spent in the weather, the barns and fields, the cars and rooms, and their looks that touched one another as if each were a lake connected by their reflections, and hidden in one was a part of the other. Here they'd gone down the road and passed the traffic signal, curved toward the narrow path along the fields. Here they counted moths and covered wells and glass bottles. Here they listened to the footsteps of an ant. Here they dressed as piles of leaves, eschewing the light so it could not reach them. And here the sound had gone, but the world could still be seen. Here was their gumption and silliness. Here the boy cried as he said things he didn't mean, like he never knew what Toto was feeling, and Toto recognized the tinge in his own chest. Here the boy said he loved him, and it was a thing so obvious and never had to be uttered except to prepare them for when it couldn't be told again. Here they slowed to a routine of a tiny scale, testing the rise and fall of their breaths because they were routinely tied together. Here Toto was going to show the boy the edge of their real imaginings. The body that does not die is not a body, and Toto was pleased to bound ahead of the boy on another path. Before the boy's mother returned, Toto left his eyes open, an empty gaze, so the boy could see him the way they had met, face to face, but also know that Toto was different. The fuzz on Toto's corneas, the absence of him blinking, his stillness sucking up air. Toto was now in the fields with the mice and the hawks and the rabbits and the foxes and the insects and the fruits and the sun. Toto was in an owl pellet they'd opened together. He was the bones, beaks, and fur. He was their bright and curious joy. From them, nothing could be taken away. The fields and the farmhouses and the animals could disappear. The dust they recognized so well could gallop, and the mice could scatter, and the cobwebs could fill room after room. Here was Toto joined to the boy like a wish, because Toto, for the boy, could wait forever.
Such a beautiful piece. Thank you so much for reading that.
Thank you for letting me read it. I never read it before. I read it the first time I wrote it, and then I barely touched it. So it's one of the chapters in the book that is as close to as the way it was first written, because every time I looked at it, I would just cry uncontrollably. And so I couldn't, in a way, go back to it too many times. And so I was really nervous because I would usually read another passage, but I wanted to start trying to challenge myself to read this moment with Toto.
I'm so glad that you did. It's a surprise that we get in the book that we get to hear from the dog. It's so special. And, you know, anyone who's had a pet can relate. But it also, you know, woven through this whole book, there's loss and there's also language. You know, there's shared language and there's language that isn't shared. And an example of language that's shared would be Henry's relationship with Toto. And, you know, it just makes me think of the larger loss of, you know, that's woven all throughout this book of the separating of North Korea from South Korea. And, you know, the renaming of things, taking that from the people and taking this shared experience and splitting it. And I just thought, you know, it's happening at a macro level all through this book. It's happening in a small way, you know, not that having a pet and losing a pet is small, but, you know, in a very personal, individual way, as well as, you know, something that affects the entire world. And I was just so struck by how you were able to do that again and again and again throughout this book. And I wondered if maybe part of that was your decision to make it polyvocal, to give so many different characters' perspectives in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that decision?
I'm trying to think about how I would sort of enter this question, because there are so many aspects to it, and you've asked such an important question about what's going on in the larger context of the book. And I think it's, for me at least, difficult to talk about without talking about my life and the way I sort of grew up and the way language was so, it felt so inaccessible to me. I didn't start speaking until I was 5. And before that, I was a mute, and I have vivid memories of before the time I could speak. And, you know, I wonder if that's attributed to the languages in household and how speaking any one language would sort of have an effect and consequence with whoever I was speaking to, whether that was trying to speak Japanese with my grandmother and that having a more dire reaction than trying to speak Korean with my parents, and then that not feeling as, I guess, fulfilling for them. That was my sense as when I spoke English. And so there were so many languages, and even more than that, outside of the home. And I wonder if that goes into the way I still feel like that child in some ways when I'm writing, and I'm just observing and listening and taking in the different perspectives, because I think what would constantly be on my mind was about how I could see everything in front of me, but as soon as I closed my eyes or turned around or went to sleep in my bedroom, it didn't make sense to me that I didn't suddenly wake up and have my mom's eyes or my dad's eyes or my dog's eyes. Why didn't I get to see their lives from their perspective? What was this whole picture that seemed cut away from me? And in a way that can be so liberating to say, oh, I understand perspective on this very rudimentary level. But at the same time, I think it could cause anxiety and feel always that there's something more to this that I'm missing. And I just would love to understand what that is. And the way to understanding that isn't always accessible through language. Sometimes I had to just sit there and watch and be silent, not necessarily silenced, which comes with other connotations, but to just be there. And so I think some of those very early urges and fears do come out in the writing in this way that I'm not sort of writing the story and then shaping it to be to have many voices and many characters. It sort of begins that way. It begins with even more characters and many more animals and voices. And the story is shaped by almost trying to pare that down to find a theme or some sort of a goal that aligns with the few of the central characters.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that you talked about perception, because I was so struck as I was reading this book with the voice, and you know, we're touching on that a little bit. It's tied up in the language, but it feels like you were capturing each character's voice in this like this impressionistic, deft, gorgeous way. Like it felt like you were saying existence is perception and absorption, and then you marry those two in art when you're trying to express it. But I felt like you were giving us these people, in some cases, you know, this animal, this place, but you weren't necessarily letting them guide or lead or shape our experience of the book. They were simply who they are. And I feel like that, to me, was the most, just in terms of like writer to writer, giving us these people, these places, these characters as they were, literally, like, as they actually are, if you could see inside them and also see what they were seeing, via this like shrewd economical beauty of the writing. And I think it's tied into what you're saying, that it was frustrating or anxiety inducing for you to not understand fully these people in your life. And the only way to do that was to sort of absorb and observe and then, you know, process it through, you know, writing and language. But I don't think I've ever encountered a book where the voice was so, was as unique as the voices in this book.
Oh, that makes me very happy. Thank you. I love what you're saying about all the characters just being who they are and being themselves and being there enough for someone else to come and observe them and see for themselves, you know, that what the relationships are between the characters without me being as explicit about those things. We just sort of see those develop with the time, over time. And it's interesting about this dog Toto, and because I, during not too long ago, it was while writing one of the drafts, and I lost my dog Ari, and I'd been with him for 14 years, and I sort of grew up in the States without my parents, and I had been sort of, my brother went off to do his own thing, and so from very, you know, in my youth and all the way into adulthood, you know, Ari was my family. And so losing him was such a significant, I had sort of, I'd experienced loss before, especially in my family, and especially just in throughout the history of my family, really. But losing my dog was just it really tore me up. And I think I sat down and that's when I decided to sort of dedicate a part of the book to Ari and how much he helped me speak. He helped me understand. He helped me commune with the rest of the world, even though it wasn't speaking in the way that you might understand that through words. So.
Absolutely. I had a professor when I was going to grad school who said, pay attention to the way that your pet inspires you. Pay attention to like the relationship you have with your pet, because it's feeding you creatively and you might not recognize that. And ever since then, I have, you know, I've had dogs pretty much my whole life. I've had my current dog Wanda for 12 years now. And it's a side of my, it's almost like a freedom. And maybe that's just through like absolute acceptance. And they're not looking at you in terms of, are you like, are you pretty? Are you put together today? Are you, you know, like they're not looking at you in those ways that we all assess each other. They're looking at your soul. I mean, I really believe that. Yeah. And if someone can see that part of you and you're letting that happen and you're also recognizing that in this partner, I'm going to straight up call it a partner.
Yeah.
I feel like that can free us creatively. Do you feel like it feeds you, that kind of relationship feeds you, you know, with your writing, with what you're making?
Definitely. And as we're speaking, my dog is barking in the background.
Yes, that is perfect.
Because we're fixing the house. And so there's a lot of ruckus going on out there.
That's funny because my basement's being worked on right now. So there's a lot of construction.
Oh, is there?
Yes.
We're doing the exact same thing. And so, yeah, I think what I remember is, so after I passed, we waited for a long while, and then we, you know, this lovely bark you hear in the background is Lily. And it's just so interesting because I'll walk Lily around and Lily would just naturally gravitate toward people, and they would start telling me how they just lost their dog like a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And it means the world to see Lily run up to them and kiss their face, and how she reminds them of their dog. And it's really devastating, but also it's beautiful to know that, you know, Lily's love is unique and it can never replace, because they're just so different, everyone's so different, but can't replace Ari's love. But it is also this pure, abundant sort of furnace of love, and that has an effect on me, but also the people around me. And I get the chance to talk to them about what that's like and how it's going for them. And that was really meaningful for me while writing this part of the book, that many, many people can understand this, and our connection to our animal companions, that also says a lot to our connection, like you said, with our soul and with our planet and with our everyday life and the relationships we have. In a way, having a wonderful relationship with your dog, it kind of teaches you that if, you know, my dog is willing to love a human being, why can't I love another human being? So in a way, dogs can also bring you closer to people. And so that's been something I've thought about.
That's such a great point, because it really is true. Dogs just naturally bring you to other people. You just find yourself talking to other people. You know, I mean, I do all the time walking my dog, and she comes with when we're dropping the kids off at school and stuff. And the more that you talk to people in this positive way, the more you, because I guess I'm trying to say that I feel like lately it's easy to kind of shut yourself off from the world. And we had to do that in the past few years because of the pandemic. And it really is like a muscle you have to flex. You have to like work on it to reopen yourself to people. And as a writer, it's so essential. It's where we get what we need, right? In order to write the next thing, we need people.
It's so true. It reminds me of just how I say this often, but I think it's so true that I couldn't have written the things I have written without sort of the people that have been behind me the whole time, or my first poetry teacher, or my first classroom or workshop. I mean, those things are still with me, and I get to bring them with me to the page. And so I think I used to believe at one point that it is just me, and that it is incredibly lonely. and the craft means you have to be alone. But I think over time I found that to be less true, and maybe it's less true because that's also what's helpful. That's also what's going to allow me to continue writing, is that no, this is sort of every word that's been said to me, every interaction I've had, that's sort of all part of what makes this book. And so in essence, the book, even you, though you might say I'm the author, it doesn't belong to me. It really belongs to the rest of the world, because that's the world in which I grew up in.
That's such a great point, because at a certain point you are handing it over, right? It was yours as you made it. And then now, and I think the way that you wrote it extends a hand to the reader. It offers these characters, this world, these voices, and the reader has to meet the book where it is, which is my favorite kind of book, because it feels like I'm being given something that I can then make something of my own with. And I don't know, I'm just in awe. I'm just in awe of it.
It's so fun listening to you and talking to you right now, because it's still quite early, I guess. And so I haven't talked to many people about the book. I haven't heard many reactions. And so this is new to me, and it's exciting to get to say, oh wow, this person read this book and they're talking about it. It's not a figment of my imagination. It's real. And wow, it's such a privilege to get to hear you talk about it. Can I ask you sort of who some of your favorite characters? Who's someone that you were really drawn to?
I really love Huron, the
yeah,
mother-in-law.
The mother-in-law.
Oh my God, I loved her. And I actually was going to ask you about that, because your first book is a memoir, but about mother and daughter, right? Mother-daughter relationship. And this book has a mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship. And it almost feels at times that Huron, is it Huron or Huron?
Yeah, Huron.
Huron.
Yeah.
Okay. Huron understands that as the mother-in-law, she must play a role, and she inhabits that role. You know, she has to sort of like throw a wrench into the relationship between her son and her daughter-in-law. You know, she has to complain. And then there's these beautiful moments where that drops away, because it really is her and Insook. It's really them together. It's been them together through this life, as Sung-ho is off doing his own thing and kind of not paying attention to the home. And there's just these beautiful couple moments where Huron is herself and isn't, you know, the stereotypical mother-in-law complaining and hating her daughter-in-law. And I loved her, because she's difficult. She's a difficult person. And then we get to see her at Easter, where she's with the other ladies at her church, and, you know, understanding that she's again not going to win the egg decorating contest, and they're very harsh to her. I don't know. She to me was such a complicated, difficult, at times unlikable, but real character. I really loved her.
I love Hunan too. When towards the end, after, well, I well, when we it, she says not a ghost, and so she's not a ghost, but she's a presence, and she's sort of looking back on everyone, and she's not really looking for her son, she's actually looking for her daughter-in-law, and imagining that, you know, this is the life they live because they were born into the roles they were born into, but in the next life she hopes that they might be reborn as sisters, and that might offer something new to them. And that's really it stays with me too, because I think my dad told me a long time ago this idea that you're born, it's a Korean belief that you're born the parent of the one that you hurt most.
Wow.
And it's sort of a way to understand the exchange you make between parent and child. And so what if we really upset my father, he might say, wow, I must have really owed you big time in the past life. I must have done something really bad to you to be getting this now. And so it's funny and it's playful, but there's another side to that, which is, it means if you don't hurt each other, if you free each other from pain and suffering, then you may never meet each other again because everything is resolved. And so what ties you together is sometime the pain you give. And a lot of the times the pain you give is the pain that you yourself was a source of. And so it's the pain you receive is the pain you give. And so it's I feel like Hudan encompasses a lot of that.
I'm struck by that. I'm thinking about, I have three kids. I'm thinking about, and they're too young, I think, for.
You're going to look at them today and be like,
what did I do?
What did I do to each of you? And
but it's true. It does give you, if I think about it that way, it gives it a level of, well, I am in service to you. I am doing my best to make it up to you. I'm doing my best to, right? Like it's giving it more grace, I think, than to just kind of be like, what's your problem? Yeah. That's quite a beautiful way of looking at it, and one I really need to think about more. After Hudan dies, spoiler, sorry everyone, the relationship between Sung-ho and In-suk is healed in a way. He's able to see her. It's literally like something falls off his eyes. Do you think it was duty to his mother, or do you think it was his mother like blotting out the sun for him?
I think it's a little bit of both, and I kind of laugh or giggle a little bit when you bring that up, because it's almost like for In-suk, she doesn't want to think that's true, that it's actually the mother-in-law that's keeping Sung-ho from her. It's Sung-ho, you know, it's him. And it's interesting that after her death, it really changes their relationship in that way. But I think a part of that was seeing the relationship between my mother and father. It was really sort of tempestuous when we all used to live together. I was born and raised here in the States. And they moved. My dad got a job offer when I was 14, and they moved together to South Korea when I was about, just as I turned 15, I believe. And it's so interesting that they were supposed to be gone for 2-3 years, and I ended up not being with them again for 9 years. But
gosh, wow.
When I would go and visit them in Korea, or when I came to move to Seattle to see them when they moved to Seattle, it was interesting because they seemed so light. They seemed lighter than ever. They seemed more in love. And I didn't want to think that it's because raising me was that hard. But I think in a way, it could also be a part of it, and that could be okay. You know, that doesn't say anything about me and even about them, but that it's difficult, you know, to live with your mother-in-law or live with your children. At the time, my mother was taking care of, you know, her mother-in-law. And so moving to Korea was not only, you know, giving her that free time. She didn't have to mother. She also didn't have to be a daughter-in-law. And, you know, it's so interesting when I see her now, we're like friends, and a lot of the work we've done together was building our friendship. And she's incredibly light and warm and outgoing. And she just seems like a young, young hearted woman. And I think, huh, it could be me. That's okay. It's hard. It's hard to be a mom, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a layer of identity over an identity you already had, right? And
right.
and in a lot of ways it's work. And but I think you're absolutely right that it's not you. You know, I think as a mother, I can safely say she probably loves and is very proud of you.
Right.
But it's the dropping away of a responsibility. Even as, I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know your mom, but
you know,
I can see exactly what you're saying.
I think that was important for me in the way that I could see her again, not just as my mom, but also as a young girl looking for her mom. You know, she was separated from her mom when she was very young. And so in a way, she went back to Korea, but she was still a daughter looking for her mom. And I suppose I was the daughter looking for her mom on this side of the world. But it helped me see what she was doing and to have love for her and to understand what it took for her to sort of leave me behind and why it was so important for her to do that.
I mean, the way that you're describing it, I can see your 5-year-old self sitting and observing and trying to understand. And it's that person is still inside you. That person is what makes you such an amazing writer.
I know, I'm still 5.
You're still it's 5. True. You're still that beautiful 5-year-old, you know, like, and your language is in impression. Your language is in perception. And somehow you're able to put that into words. That's incredible.
It's so funny. I think the people I've grown up with, and they still kind of laugh about it because I was a really difficult child. I couldn't speak. I was terrible in school, and I was the teachers would recommend my mother to put me in different programs for sort of assisted learning or possibly just maybe, you know, school was not meant for me. And this was sort of continuous throughout my years, and I didn't understand what school was for in a way. I just did it because I was supposed to, and I let it, I sort of, and it wasn't until maybe just as I was graduating from undergrad, my counselor, and I was still alone at the time, but my counselor said, you really need to take a math requirement to graduate. But because you're having a hard time, I'll let you take a poetry class as a replacement. And so just as I was ready to leave and say, I'm done with this and I don't have to deal with teachers or this atmosphere and this whole learning thing, I just don't get it, I walked into my first poetry class, and then I left and I wrote maybe 40 poems the first week.
What?
And my teacher just sat me down and said, I know you are about to leave the city and you just want to get out of school before you fail out. And but I really want to talk to you about poetry. I really think that there's something that you're trying to say here. And there's something that you're saying very well. And I just never heard that before. I didn't even know what a poem was. And I was already, you know, probably much older than maybe 18, 19 by then, and thinking, oh wow, I can kind of communicate through poetry. And it was unlike anything else I'd come across. And so he introduced me to the poetry director at UCI, Susan Davis, and she took me under her wing. You know, she took me in, talked to me, told me about her love and life, and how to observe, how to listen, how to read, and how to care. I think genuinely, I didn't know how to care about something at all. I didn't know what that felt like for me, and I didn't know how to do that for anyone else or even the things around me. And it was through her that I really understood, oh, I see what it is. Poetry is a form of learning how to care. It's learning, and observing is a form of learning how to give. And so I would say that's when I understood, oh, this is what it's for. It's school. It's not for school. Everything's there for me to take what I learned here and do something with it. And so Yeah.
This is blowing my mind. What do you think it was about that first poetry class that inspired you, that it almost sounds like it freed you to write 40, you said 40 poems in the first
Yeah.
week?
And yeah, I put them in a folder and gave them to my poetry teacher.
What do you think it was? Like, what opened the door for you?
I just remember walking into this really old trailer in the intro to poetry class, and the graduate teacher, Greg McClure, and he made us read a poem called The Vegetables by James McMichael. And it has sort of every stanza or every section has a title of a vegetable. And our job for that first day in class was to try to, we split up in groups and try to figure out as a group what this poem is about. And then we would come together at the end and argue about it. And it was incredible, because we said, oh, it's about life, it's about birth, it's about this and that. And when Greg said, actually, it's about his mother. It's about his mother he's caring for in the hospital. And you could tell that by how, these vegetables have like a skull-like quality to them, how the fireplaces are cold in the hospital. He said you could get a sense of what's actually going on by reading about these vegetables that she's dying of cancer, because the cancer's like the potatoes that grow inside her. They grow under the ground and they hold her still under the ground. And he would walk us through these images and the language of why it means this thing, and that it can mean no other thing but this. And like all the other meanings sort of come from this source that he's taking care of his dying mother. And I think that must have had an effect on me to say, like, you can say things without saying them, and you can mean things differently when you do say them, and that language has all these layers and ways of communicating that can touch each other deeply. It's almost like the words themselves don't matter. It doesn't matter that you see the word vegetable and these little root vegetables and whatnot. What matters is what you feel by reading these words together. And it's the feelings, it's through the feelings that we're connected, through the experience of our emotions, because our experiences are unique and words are unique, and what we assign to each word in terms of images, it's all unique. But the experience of our emotions, that's not unique, that's quite universal. And so I think that was a triggering point for me in understanding I could communicate by expressing how I feel.
That's beautiful. That's amazing. Do you remember what you were writing about in those first 40 poems?
Yeah, of course. I was writing a lot about my mother and my relationship to my mother, sort of raising myself in this little house that she'd moved me to about 100 miles from where we used to be. And I would put Tabasco in boiling water and drink that, because it just reminded me of the soup she'd make me in the morning. But I would just douse Tabasco all over it, because that was the most sort of the taste, the memory. And I would write poems about things like the food she'd ship over, like she'd ship kimchi over and it would ripen on the trip, because the kimchi needs to sort of age, it needs to ferment. And through those poems, I think it was Susan, the poetry director, sat me down, and this was a really big lesson for me. And probably one of the things I teach now is that, she said, all your poems, you really know how to start a poem, and you really know how to fill out a poem, but you don't know how to do the turn, which is the end of the poem. And she said, you're missing magnanimity. And a poem isn't a poem unless it has magnanimity. And I was like, I've never heard this word before. What does it mean? She said, it means at least by the end of the poem, you have to forgive your mother, or the poem has to forgive you for not. Otherwise, it's not a poem. It's a journal, or it's a diary, or it's something you've scribbled down. but magnanimity is what makes a piece of writing a poem. And so I went about writing the memoir, rewriting it several times to remind myself that I'm not writing this to say who was right and wrong. I'm writing this to find the magnanimity to understand what was happening. And I think I wanted to understand the characters in the same way with the liberators. I think the liberators is very much a part of the magical language of others. It's almost an extension in that way.
I've never heard that notion about the turn at the end, including magnanimity. I think in some ways it's true for all kinds of writing. It's what differentiates, you know, just like she said, what's differentiates it from journaling is it's accessing that universal emotion that you were talking about, right? Like we can all be angry at your mother with you, but there has to be something universal that makes it art, right?
Right, right.
Susan Davis. Incredible.
I know.
I wanted to bring up Robert to bring it back to the liberators. Yeah. He is such an interesting character. And I feel like he... there's this notion of apology all throughout the book. This idea that if there's just the right apology, you know, then things can heal, or they can revert, or they can become anew. And I think that's sort of an ask for an acknowledgement of the trauma of the break of what was done to Korea and continues to be done. And do you feel like it almost feels like that this quest of his is absolutely right. He's absolutely right. That is deserved. That is needed. But that it's doomed because even if that ever happens, it wouldn't be enough.
Yeah. I really love when Robert, and it's really Henry that's reflecting on Robert. And I think Henry sees Robert in a beautiful way that maybe nobody else does. Sort of Henry's eyes can see Robert this way. But he recalls when Robert told him that an apology isn't just saying you're sorry, saying that I wish it never happened. By the end of the book, he's saying that an apology is when you also imagine the losses and imagine a future had those losses not occurred and the loss of that future. And so when he said that, I think it came from a place from reading about, learning and seeing so many famous apologies throughout history from countries or presidents, or certainly we see pictures and images, but and we also see them on memorials. We also see them on sort of reconciliation sites and monuments as well. But I very rarely came across this idea of imagination also being important to an apology. Not to say that that would suffice, but that we do have to use almost our creativity to fully understand and to fully put in our minds the future that's not going to happen because of what occurred. And that loss, I mean, once understood, that loss isn't just a loss in the past, then that loss is in continuity. It's sort of a loss that happens in the present constantly, because it's the present is sort of parallel to what could have been or what should have been. And that's the life we're living. And an acknowledgement of that is, I think, the beginning of what an apology tries to do. And I think Robert was trying to teeter toward that. But I think something interesting about Robert is that he does give up everything else for his sort of moral, ethical values, for, you know, the of what happened with Korea, US, and Japan. And I think over time, I saw through his actions and his words that something that's missing, and I come across even in my academic work, is a conversation about love, because you'd think that love is very separate from those conversations, that, you know, love isn't involved in reparation, it's not involved in apology, it's not involved in taking stock of, you know, lost history or, you know, burnt records and whatnot. But I think love is something that's really important to talk about and needs to be there in any conversation that has to do with reparation or liberation, this need and this willingness to talk about, oh, well, we also want to do this with love. And I think In-sung does that. I think Song-ho succeeds in that. It's almost like all our efforts toward liberation is really in vain without love. Love has to be a component of that.
Is that what you would say? Do you have any hope or optimism for relations between North and South Korea? Is it rooted in love, your optimism, if you have any?
That's so interesting, because I think U.S. plays such a big role in the way we portray North Korea as, instead of sort of really looking at the North Korean people and also U.S. role in what happened, and just a global acknowledgement of my goodness, what all the atrocities that occurred on that peninsula and that affected people beyond. But I think what's interesting is that being a Korean American, I really want to come to that table. I really want to set that table and see, well, I think there are perspectives from the Korean diaspora that is also part of Korean history that maybe isn't as talked about, I would say, among Korean nationalists, right? Like Korean Americans or any Korean outside of the main peninsula. Like, what is their relationship to the border and what happened? Is there a relationship at all? I mean, those are some of the questions that are asked. And I think I was really compelled by that to say, of course, you know, I think the way we, I think also about the way we hold memory. And I believe Elizabeth Rosner talks about this really beautifully in Survivor Cafe, where she does research on the Holocaust, but also, you know, sort of other terrible mass events across world history. And she talks about how we have different types of memory. We have a sort of national memory or state memory. It's the memory that's sort of sanctioned. And then we have a collective memory, which might be the memory of our community and those around us. Then we have like an individual memory that is, and this is part of something I'm adding on to that, the individual memory of the way we remember things to have happened. Mm-hmm. And an example of that is, you know, state memory in Korea might say, you know, my great grandfather wasn't stoned to death by Korean national police, but we don't know that. But that's sort of the memory that my father and my dad's side of the family would have to have had to survive. Otherwise, they would sort of face persecution. It's like how much of that state memory imposed on the collective memory that says that might not be true. You know, mm-hmm. you know, national police might have very well come on to Jeju Island, we know that they did, backed by U.S., but that they were also involved in the stonings that happened, and so. So that collective memory really, it even hit, and we see state memory in something like a memorial, like really, like you see the black marble or really kind of spare And then you see collective memory. Sometimes you'll see that when you drive and you see a little poster at a corner with a photograph and some flowers of, you know, someone who might have passed there. But that vividness, that colorfulness, that personal element, that's more collective memory, and protecting the collective memory against state memory is something I've thought about when it comes to well let's start from the beginning. How can we even agree on what happened? You know, can we even talk about that? And that's one of the things that come into that become contentious when talking about the North and South. And also there's individual memory, the things we have and the sort of hurt that is stored in our bodies and that our forebears also have in their bodies, and that we have to reckon with to understand where is this all coming from.
EJ, thank you so much. This has been such an incredible conversation. You are brilliant. This book is brilliant. It is heartbreaking, gorgeous, funny, sad. It's everything. I think people are going to freak out.
Oh, thank you. I really hope that the stories in here and the characters do allow us to have conversations like the one we're having, like one we had today with you. I mean, that's sort of what it's all for. It's for this moment and to share it with you, and for someone to say, hey, tell me more about what's happening on the peninsula. Tell me more about our memories, our dogs, our, you know, our writing. And that's really, I think, the goal. So thank you for doing this.
It's a beautiful starting point for connection that you've created. And I am so honored that you came on to talk to me about it. Thank you so much.